Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
It's Kelly Clarkson here to talk all things Wayfair, the best place to buy furniture, decor, and anything else you can think of to create a home you absolutely love. I know when I shop with Wayfair, I find options for every style, whether I'm feeling boho or farmhouse, modern, traditional, French country. I can find exactly what I need for my home and more. No matter your space, style, or budget, shop Wayfair.com to make your home way more you.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Chapter 8 of The Eye of Osiris by R. Austin Freeman. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 8. A Museum Idol. Whether it was that practice revived a forgotten skill on my part, or that Miss Bellingham had overestimated the amount of work to be done, I am unable to say. But whichever may have been the explanation, the fact is that the fourth afternoon saw our task so nearly completed that I was fain to plead that a small remainder might be left over to form an excuse for yet one more visit to the reading room. Short, however, as had been the period of our collaboration, it had been long enough to produce a great change in our relations to one another. For there is no friendship so intimate and satisfying as that engendered by community of work, and none between man and woman, at any rate, so frank and wholesome. Every day had arrived to find a pile of books with the places duly marked and the blue-covered quarto notebooks in readiness. Every day we had worked steadily at the allotted task, had then handed in the books and gone forth together to enjoy a most companionable tea in the milk shop. Thereafter to walk home by way of Queen's Square, talking over the day's work and discussing the state of the world in the far-off days when Akhenaten was king and the Tel El Amarna tablets were a-writing. It had been a pleasant time, so pleasant that as I handed in the books for the last time, I sighed to think that it was over, that not only was the task finished, but that the recovery of my fair patient's hand from which I had that morning removed the splint had put an end to the need of my help. "What shall we do?" I asked, as we came out into the central hall. "It is too early for tea. Shall we go and look at some of the galleries?" "Why not?" she answered. "We might look over some of the things connected with what we have been doing. For instance, there is a relief of Akhenaten upstairs in the third Egyptian room. We might go and look at it." I fell in eagerly with the suggestion, placing myself under her experienced guidance, and we started by way of the Roman gallery, past the long row of extremely commonplace and modern-looking Roman emperors. "I don't know," she said, pausing for a moment opposite a bust labeled Trajan, but obviously a portrait of Phil May, "how I am ever to thank you for all that you have done, to say nothing of repayment." "There is no need to do either," I replied. "I have enjoyed working with you, so I have had my reward. But still," I added, "if you want to do me a great kindness, you have it in your power."
"How?"
"In connection with my friend Dr. Thorndike. I told you he was an enthusiast. Now he is for some reason most keenly interested in everything relating to your uncle, and I happen to know that if any legal proceedings should take place, he would very much like to keep a friendly eye on the case."
"And what do you want me to do?"
"I want you, if an opportunity should occur for him to give your father advice or help of any kind, to use your influence with your father in favor of, rather than in opposition to, his accepting it, always assuming that you have no real feeling against his doing so." Miss Bellingham looked at me thoughtfully for a few moments and then laughed softly. "So the great kindness that I am to do you is to let you do a further kindness through your friend?" "No," I protested, "that is where you are mistaken. It isn't benevolence on Dr. Thorndike's part, it's professional enthusiasm." She smiled skeptically. "You don't believe in it," I said, "but consider other cases. Why does a surgeon get out of bed on a winter's night to do an emergency operation at a hospital? He doesn't get paid for it. Do you think it is altruism?"
"Yes, of course, isn't it?" Certainly not. He does it because it is his job, because it is his business to fight with disease and win.
I don't see much difference, she said. It's work done for love instead of for payment. However, I will do as you ask if the opportunity arises. But I shan't suppose that I am repaying your kindness to me.
I don't mind so long as you do it, I said, and we walked on for some time in silence.
Isn't it odd, she said presently, how our talks always seem to come back to my uncle? Oh, and that reminds me that the things he gave to the museum are in the same room as the Akhenaten relief. Would you like to see them?
Of course I should.
Then we will go and look at them first. She paused, and then rather shyly and with a rising color she continued, And I think I should like to introduce you to a very dear friend of mine, with your permission, of course. This last addition she made hastily, seeing, I suppose, that I looked rather glum at the suggestion. Inwardly I consigned her friend to the devil, especially if of the masculine gender. Outwardly I expressed my felicity at making the acquaintance of any person whom she should honor with her friendship. Whereat, to my discomfiture, she laughed enigmatically, a very soft laugh, low-pitched and musical, like the cooing of a glorified pigeon. I strolled on by her side, speculating a little anxiously on the coming introduction. Was I being conducted to the lair of one of the savants attached to the establishment? And would he add a superfluous third to our little party of two, so complete and companionable, solus cum sola, in this populated wilderness? Above all, would he turn out to be a young man, and bring my aerial castles tumbling about my ears? The shy look and the blush with which she had suggested the introduction were ominous indications, upon which I mused gloomily as we ascended the stairs and passed through the wide doorway. I glanced apprehensively at my companion and made a quiet, inscrutable smile, and at that moment she halted opposite a wall-case and faced me. "This is my friend," she said. "Let me present you to Artemidorus, late of Phaeum." "Oh, don't smile," she pleaded. "I am quite serious. Have you never heard of pious Catholics who cherish a devotion to some long-departed saint? That is my feeling toward Artemidorus. And if you only knew what comfort he has shed into the heart of a lonely woman, what a quiet, unobtrusive friend he has been to me in my solitary, friendless days, always ready with a kindly greeting on his gentle, thoughtful face, you would like him for that alone. And I want you to like him and to share our silent friendship. Am I very silly, very sentimental?" A wave of relief swept over me, and the mercury of my emotional thermometer, which had shrunk almost into the bulb, leapt up to summer heat. How charming it was of her, and how sweetly intimate, to wish to share this mystical friendship with me! And what a pretty conceit it was, too, and how like this strange, inscrutable maiden, to come here and hold silent converse with this long-departed Greek! And the pathos of it all touched me deeply amidst the joy of this newborn intimacy. "Are you scornful?" she asked, with a shade of disappointment, as I made no reply. "No, indeed I am not," I answered earnestly. "I want to make you aware of my sympathy and my appreciation without offending you by seeming to exaggerate, and I don't know how to express it." "Oh, never mind about the expression, so long as you feel it. I thought you would understand," and she gave me a smile that made me tingle to my fingertips. We stood a while gazing in silence at the mummy, for such indeed was her friend Artemidorus. But not an ordinary mummy. Egyptian in form, it was entirely Greek in feeling, and brightly colored as it was, in accordance with the racial love of color, the tasteful refinement with which the decoration of the case was treated made those around look garish and barbaric. But the most striking feature was a charming panel picture which occupied the place of the usual mask. This painting was a revelation to me. Except that it was executed in tempera instead of oil, it differed in no respect from modern work. There was nothing archaic or ancient about it. With its freedom of handling and its correct rendering of light and shade, it might have been painted yesterday. Indeed, enclosed in an ordinary gilt frame, it might have passed without remark in an exhibition of modern portraits. Miss Bellingham observed my admiration and smiled approvingly. "It is a charming little portrait, isn't it?" she said. "And such a sweet face, too, so thoughtful and human, with just a shade of melancholy. But the whole thing is full of charm. I fell in love with it the first time I saw it.
and it is so Greek. Yes, it is, in spite of the Egyptian gods and symbols. Rather because of them, I think, said she. There we have the typical Greek attitude, the genial cultivated eclecticism that appreciated the fitness of even the most alien forms of art. There is Anubis standing beside the bier, there are Isis and Nephthys, and there below Horus and Tahuti. But we can't suppose Artemidorus worshipped or believed in those gods. They are there because they are splendid decoration and perfectly appropriate in character. The real feeling of those who love the dead man breaks out in the inscription. She pointed to a band below the pectoral, where in gilt capital letters was written the two words, Artemidor Epsici. Yes, I said, it is very dignified and very human. And so sincere and full of real emotion, she added. I find it unspeakably touching. Oh, Artemidorus, farewell. There is the real note of human grief, the sorrow of eternal parting. How much finer it is than the vulgar boastfulness of the Semitic epitaphs, or our own miserable insincere make-believe of the not lost but gone before type. He was gone from them forever. They would look on his face and hear his voice no more. They realized that this was their last farewell. Oh, there is a world of love and sorrow in those two simple words. For some time neither of us spoke. The glamour of this touching memorial of a long-buried grief had stolen over me, and I was content to stand silent by my beloved companion and revive, with a certain pensive pleasure, the ghosts of human emotions over which so many centuries had rolled. Presently she turned to me with a frank smile. "You have been weighed in the balance of friendship," she said, "and not found wanting. You have the gift of sympathy, even with a woman's sentimental fancies." I suspected that a good many men would have developed this precious quality under the circumstances, but I refrained from saying so. There is no use in crying down one's own wares. I was glad enough to have earned her good opinion so easily, and when she at length turned away from the case and passed through into the adjoining room, it was a very complacent young man who bore her company. Here is Akhenaten, or Kuenaten, as the authorities here render the hieroglyphics. She indicated a fragment of a colored relief labeled portion of a painted stone tablet with a portrait figure of Amenhotep IV, and we stopped to look at the frail, effeminate figure of the great king, with his large cranium, his queer pointed chin, and the Aten rays stretching out their weird hands as if caressing him. "We mustn't stay here if you want to see my uncle's gift, because this room closes at 4 today." With this admonition, she moved on to the other end of the room, where she halted before a large floor case containing a mummy and a large number of other objects. A black label with white lettering set forth the various contents with a brief explanation as follows. "Mummy of Sebekhotep, a scribe of the 22nd dynasty, together with the objects found in the tomb. These include the 4 canopic jars, in which the internal organs were deposited, the Ushabti figures, tomb provisions, and various articles that had belonged to the deceased, his favorite chair, his headrest, his ink palette, inscribed with his name and the name of the king, Osorkon I, in whose reign he lived, and other smaller articles. Presented by John Bellingham, Esquire." "They have put all the objects together in one case," Miss Bellingham explained, "to show the contents of an ordinary tomb of the better class. You see that the dead man was provided with all his ordinary comforts, provisions, furniture, the ink palette that he had been accustomed to use in writing on papyri, and a staff of servants to wait on him." "Where are the servants?" I asked. "The little Ushabti figure," she answered. "They were the attendants of the dead, you know, his servants in the underworld. It was a quaint idea, wasn't it? But it was all very complete and consistent, and quite reasonable, too, if one accepts the belief in the persistence of the individual apart from the body." "Yes," I agreed, "and that is the only fair way to judge a religious system, by taking the main beliefs for granted. But what a business it must have been bringing all these things from Egypt to London." "It is worth the trouble, though, for it is a fine and instructive collection, and the work is all very good of its kind. You notice that the Ushabti figures and the heads that form the stoppers of the canopic jars are quite finely modeled. The mummy itself, too, is rather handsome, though that coat of bitumen on the back doesn't improve it." but Sebek Hotep must have been a fine-looking man.
The mask on the face is a portrait, I suppose?
Yes, in fact, it's rather more. To some extent, it is the actual face of the man himself. This mummy is enclosed in what is called a cartonnage, that is, a case molded on the figure. The cartonnage was formed of a number of layers of linen or papyrus united by glue or cement, and when the case has been fitted to a mummy, it was molded to the body so that the general form of the features and limbs was often apparent. After the cement was dry, the case was covered with a thin layer of stucco, and the face modeled more completely, and then decorations and inscriptions were painted on. So that, you see, in a cartonnage, the body was sealed up like a nut in its shell, unlike the more ancient forms in which the mummy was merely rolled up and enclosed in a wooden coffin. At this moment there smote upon our ears a politely protesting voice announcing in sing-song tones that it was closing time, and simultaneously a desire for tea suggested the hospitable milk-shop. With leisurely dignity that ignored the official who shepherded us along the galleries, we made our way to the entrance, still immersed in conversation on matters sepulchral. It was rather earlier than our usual hour for leaving the museum, and moreover it was our last day, for the present. Wherefore we lingered over our tea to an extent that caused the milk-shop lady to view us with some disfavor, and when at length we started homeward, we took so many shortcuts that 6 o'clock found us no nearer our destination than Lincoln's Inn Fields, whither we had journeyed by a slightly indirect route that traversed, among other places, Russell Square, Red Lion Square, with the quaint passage of the same name, Bedford Row, Jockey's Fields, Hand Court, and Great Turnstile. It was in the last thoroughfare that our attention was attracted by a flaring poster outside a newsvendor's bearing the startling inscription, More Mementos of Murdered Man. Miss Bellingham glanced at the poster and shuddered.
Horrible, isn't it? She said. Have you read about them?
I haven't been noticing the papers the last few days, I replied.
No, of course you haven't. You've been slaving at those wretched notes.
We don't very often see the papers, at least we don't take them in, but Miss Omen has kept us supplied during the last day or two. She is a perfect little ghoul. She delights in horrors of every kind, and the more horrible the better.
But I asked, what is it they have found?
Oh, they are the remains of some poor creature who seems to have been murdered and cut into pieces. It is dreadful. It made me shudder to read it, for I couldn't help thinking of poor Uncle John, and as for my father, he was really quite upset.
Are these the bones that were found in a watercress bed at Sidcup?
Yes, but they have found several more. The police have been most energetic. They seem to have been making a systematic search, and the result has been that they have discovered several portions of the body, scattered about in very widely separated places, Sidcup, Lee, St. Mary Cray, and yesterday it was reported that an arm had been found in one of the ponds called the Cuckoo Pits, close to our old home.
What, in Essex? I exclaimed.
Yes, in Epping Forest, quite near Woodford. Isn't it dreadful to think of it? They were probably hidden when we were living there. I think it was that horrified my father so much. When he read it, he was so upset that he gathered up the whole bundle of newspapers and tossed them out of the window, and they blew over the wall, and poor Miss Omen had to rush and pursue them up the court.
Do you think he suspects that these remains may be those of your uncle?
I think so, though he has said nothing to that effect, and of course I have not made any suggestion to him. We always preserve the fiction between ourselves of believing that Uncle John is still alive.
But you don't think he is, do you?
No, I'm afraid I don't, and I feel pretty sure that my father doesn't think so either, but he doesn't like to admit it to me.
Do you happen to remember what bones have been found?
No, I don't. I know that an arm was found in the Cuckoo Pits, and I think a thigh bone was dredged up out of a pond near St. Mary Cray. But Miss Omen will be able to tell you all about it if you are interested. She will be delighted to meet a kindred spirit, Miss Bellingham added with a smile.
I don't know that I claim spiritual kinship with a ghoul, said I, especially such a very sharp-tempered ghoul.
Oh, don't disparage her, Dr. Berkeley, Miss Bellingham pleaded. She isn't really bad-tempered, only a little prickly on the surface. I oughtn't to have called her a ghoul. She is just the sweetest, most affectionate, most unselfish little angelic human hedgehog that you could find,
if you traveled the wide world through. Do you know that she has been working her fingers to the bone, making an old dress of mine presentable because she is so anxious that I should look nice at your little supper party?
You are sure to do that in any case, I said, but I withdraw my remark as to her temper unreservedly. And I really didn't mean it, you know. I have always liked the little lady.
That's right. And now won't you come in and have a few minutes' chat with my father? We are quite early in spite of the shortcuts.
I accepted readily, and the more so inasmuch as I wanted a few words with Miss Oman on the subject of catering and did not want to discuss it before my friends. Accordingly, I went in and gossiped with Mr. Bellingham, chiefly about the work we had done at the museum, until it was time for me to return to the surgery. Having taken my leave, I walked down the stairs with reflective slowness and as much creaking of my boots as I could manage, with the result, hopefully anticipated, that as I approached the door of Miss Oman's room it opened and the lady's head protruded.
"I'd change my cobbler if I were you," she said.
I thought of the angelic human hedgehog and nearly sniggered in her face.
"I am sure you would, Miss Oman, instantly, though, mind you, the poor fellow can't help his looks."
"You are a very flippant young man," she said severely, whereat I grinned and she regarded me silently with a baleful glare. Suddenly I remembered my mission and became serious and sober. "Miss Oman," I said, "I very much want to take your advice on a matter of some importance, to me at least."
That ought to fetch her, I thought. The advice fly, strangely neglected by Isaac Walton, is guaranteed to kill in any weather. And it did fetch her. She rose in a flash and gorged it, cock's feathers, worsted body and all.
"What is it about?" she asked eagerly. "But don't stand out there where everybody can hear but me. Come in and sit down."
Now, I didn't want to discuss the matter here, and besides, there was not time. I therefore assumed an air of mystery.
"I can't, Miss Oman. I'm due at the surgery now. But if you should be passing and should have a few minutes to spare, I should be greatly obliged if you would look in. I really don't quite know how to act."
"No, I expect not. Men very seldom do. But you're better than most, for you know when you are in difficulties and have the sense to consult a woman. But what is it about? Perhaps I might be thinking it over."
"Well, you know," I began evasively, "it's a simple matter, but I can't very well—" "No, by Jove," I added, looking at my watch, "I must run, or I shall keep the multitude waiting." And with this I bustled away, leaving her literally dancing with curiosity. End of chapter 8.
Chapter 9 of The Eye of Osiris by R. Austin Freeman. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 9. The Sphinx of Lincoln's Inn. At the age of 26, one cannot claim to have attained to the position of a person of experience. Nevertheless, the knowledge of human nature accumulated in that brief period sufficed to make me feel confident that, at some time during the evening, I should receive a visit from Miss Oman. And circumstances justified my confidence, for the clock yet stood at 7:02 when a premonitory tap at the surgery door heralded her arrival. "I happen to be passing," she explained, and I forbore to smile at the coincidence, "so I thought I might as well drop in and hear what you wanted to ask me about." She seated herself in the patient's chair and, laying a bundle of newspapers on the table, glared at me expectantly.
"Thank you, Miss Oman," said I. "It is very good of you to look in on me. I am ashamed to give you all this trouble about such a trifling matter."
She rapped her knuckles impatiently on the table.
"Never mind about the trouble," she exclaimed tartly. "What is it that you want to ask me about?"
I stated my difficulties in respect of the supper party, and as I proceeded, an expression of disgust and disappointment spread over her countenance.
"I don't see why you need have been so mysterious about it," she said glumly.
"I didn't mean to be mysterious. I was only anxious not to make a mess of the affair. It's all very fine to assume a lofty scorn of the pleasures of the table, but there is great virtue in a really good feed, especially when low living and high thinking have been the order of the day."
"Coarsely put," said Miss Oman, "but perfectly true."
"Very well. Now, if I leave the management to Mrs. Gummer, she will probably provide a tepid Irish stew with flakes of congealed fat on it,
and a plastic suet pudding or something of that kind, and turn the house upside down in getting it ready. So I thought of having a cold spread and getting the things from outside, but I don't want it to look as if I had been making enormous preparations.
They won't think the things came down from heaven, said Miss O'Man.
No, I suppose they won't, but you know what I mean. Now, where do you advise me to go for the raw materials of conviviality?
Miss O'Man reflected.
You had better let me do your shopping and manage the whole business, was her final verdict.
This was precisely what I wanted, and I accepted thankfully, regardless of the feelings of Mrs. Gummer.
I handed her £2, and after some protests at my extravagance, she bestowed them in her purse, a process that occupied time, since that receptacle, besides being a sort of miniature record office of frayed and time-stained bills, already bulged with a lading of draper samples, ends of tape, a card of linen buttons, another of hooks and eyes, a lump of beeswax, a rat-eaten stump of lead pencil, and other trifles that I have forgotten. As she closed the purse at the imminent risk of wrenching off its fastenings, she looked at me severely and pursed her lips.
"You're a very plausible young man," she remarked.
"What makes you say that?" I asked.
"Philandering about museums," she continued, "with handsome young ladies on the pretense of work."
"Work, indeed! Oh, I heard her telling her father about it. She thinks you were perfectly enthralled by the mummies and dried cats and chunks of stone and all the other trash. She doesn't know what humbugs men are."
"Really, Miss O'Man," I began.
"Oh, don't talk to me," she snapped. "I can see it all. You can't impose upon me. I can see you staring into those glass cases, egging her on to talk and listening open mouth and bulging eye and sitting at her feet. Now, didn't you?"
"I don't know about sitting at her feet," I said, "though it might easily have come to that with those infernal slippery floors. But I had a very jolly time, and I mean to go again if I can. Miss Bellingham is the cleverest and most accomplished woman I have ever spoken to."
This was a poser for Miss O'Man, whose admiration and loyalty I knew were only equaled by my own. She would have liked to contradict me, but the thing was impossible. To cover her defeat, she snatched up the bundle of newspapers and began to open them out.
"What sort of stuff is hibernation?" she demanded suddenly.
"Hibernation?" I exclaimed.
"Yes, they found a patch of it on a bone that was discovered in a pond at St. Mary Cray, and a similar patch on one that was found at some other place in Essex. Now I want to know what hibernation is."
"You must mean eburnation," I said after a moment's reflection.
"The newspapers say hibernation, and I suppose they know what they are talking about. If you don't know what it is, don't be ashamed to say so."
"Well, then I don't."
"In that case, you had better read the papers and find out," she said, a little illogically. And then, "Are you fond of murders?"
"I am awfully."
"What a shocking little ghoul you must be," I exclaimed. She stuck out her chin at me.
"I'll trouble you," she said, "to be a little more respectful in your language. Do you realize that I am old enough to be your mother?"
"Impossible," I ejaculated.
"Fact," said Miss O'Man.
"Well, anyhow," said I, "age is not the only qualification. And besides, you are too late for the billet. The vacancy's filled."
Miss O'Man slapped the papers down on the table and rose abruptly.
"You had better read the papers and see if you can learn a little sense," she said severely as she turned to go.
"Oh, and don't forget the finger," she added eagerly. "That is really thrilling."
"The finger?" I repeated.
"Yes, they found a hand with one missing. The police think it is an important clue. I don't know what they mean, but you read the account and tell me what you think."
With this parting injunction, she bustled out through the surgery, and I followed to bid her a ceremonious adieu on the doorstep. I watched her little figure tripping with quick, bird-like steps down Fetter Lane, and was about to turn back into the surgery when my attention was attracted by the evolutions of an elderly gentleman on the opposite side of the street. He was a somewhat peculiar-looking man, tall, gaunt, and bony, and the way in which he carried his head suggested to the medical mind a pronounced degree of near-sight and a pair of deep spectacle glasses. Suddenly he espied me and crossed the road with his chin thrust forward and a pair of keen blue eyes directed at me through the centers of his spectacles.
"I wonder if you can and will help me," said he, with a courteous salute.
I wish to call on an acquaintance, and I have forgotten his address. It is in some court, but the name of that court has escaped me for the moment. My friend's name is Bellingham. I suppose you don't chance to know it? Doctors know a great many people as a rule.
Do you mean Mr. Godfrey Bellingham?
Ah, then you do know him. I have not consulted the oracle in vain.
He is a patient of yours, no doubt?
A patient and a personal friend. His address is 49 Neville's Court.
Thank you, thank you.
Oh, and as you are a friend, perhaps you can inform me as to the customs of the household. I am not expected, and I do not wish to make an untimely visit. What are Mr. Bellingham's habits as to his evening meal? Would this be a convenient time to call?
I generally make my evening visits a little later than this, say about 8:30. They have finished their meal by then.
Ah, 8:30 then. Then I suppose I had better take a walk until that time. I don't want to disturb them.
Would you care to come in and smoke a cigar until it is time to make your call? If you would, I could walk over with you and show you the house.
That is very kind of you, said my new acquaintance, with an inquisitive glance at me through his spectacles. I think I should like to sit down. It's a dull affair, mooning about the streets, and there isn't time to go back to my chambers in Lincoln's Inn.
I wonder, said I, as I ushered him into the room lately vacated by Miss Omen, if you happen to be Mr. Jellicoe.
He turned his spectacles full on me with a keen, suspicious glance.
What makes you think I am Mr. Jellicoe? He asked.
Oh, only that you live in Lincoln's Inn.
Ha, I see. I live in Lincoln's Inn, Mr. Jellicoe lives in Lincoln's Inn, therefore I am Mr. Jellicoe.
Ha, ha, bad logic, but a correct conclusion. Yes, I am Mr. Jellicoe. What do you know about me?
Mighty little, excepting that you were the late John Bellingham's man of business.
The late John Bellingham, eh? How do you know he is the late John Bellingham?
As a matter of fact, I don't, only I rather understood that that was your own belief.
You understood. Now, from whom did you understand that?
From Godfrey Bellingham?
Hm.
And how did he know what I believe?
I never told him.
It is a very unsafe thing, my dear sir, to expound another man's beliefs.
Then you think that John Bellingham is alive?
Do I? Who said so? I did not, you know.
But he must either be dead or alive.
There, said Mr. Jellicoe, I am entirely with you. You have stated an undeniable truth.
It is not a very illuminating one, however, I replied, laughing.
Undeniable truths often are not, he retorted. They are apt to be extremely general. In fact, I would affirm that the certainty of the truth of a given proposition is directly proportional to its generality.
I suppose that is so, said I.
Undoubtedly. Take an instance from your own profession. Given 1,000,000 normal human beings under 20, and you can say with certainty that a majority of them will die before reaching a certain age, that they will die in certain circumstances and of certain diseases. Then take a single unit from that 1,000,000, and what can you predict concerning him?
Nothing.
He may die tomorrow. He may live to be a couple of hundred. He may die of a cold in the head or of a cut finger or from falling off the cross of St. Paul's. In a particular case, you can predict nothing.
That is perfectly true, said I.
And then, realizing that I had been led away from the topic of John Bellingham, I ventured to return to it.
That was a very mysterious affair, the disappearance of John Bellingham, I mean.
Why mysterious? Asked Mr. Jellicoe. Men disappear from time to time, and when they reappear, the explanations that they give, when they give any, seem more or less adequate.
But the circumstances were surely rather mysterious.
What circumstances? Asked Mr. Jellicoe.
I mean the way in which he vanished from Mr. Hurst's house.
In what way did he vanish from it?
Well, of course, I don't know.
Precisely. Neither do I. Therefore, I can't say whether that was a mysterious one or not.
It is not even certain that he did leave it, I remarked, rather recklessly.
Exactly, said Mr. Jellicoe. And if he did not, he is there still.
And if he is there still, he has not disappeared, in the sense understood.
And if he has not disappeared, there is no mystery. I laughed heartily, but Mr. Jellicoe preserved a wooden solemnity and continued to examine me through his spectacles.
which I in my turn inspected and estimated at about -5 diopters. There was something highly diverting about this grim lawyer, with his dry contentiousness and almost farcical caution. His ostentatious reserve encouraged me to ply him with fresh questions, the more indiscreet the better. "I suppose," said I, "that under these circumstances you would hardly favor Mr. Hurst's proposal to apply for permission to presume death?"
"Under what circumstances?" he inquired.
"I was referring to the doubt you have expressed as to whether John Bellingham is, after all, really dead."
"My dear sir," said he, "I fail to see your point. If it were certain that the man was alive, it would be impossible to presume that he was dead. And if it were certain that he was dead, presumption of death would still be impossible. You do not presume a certainty. The uncertainty is of the essence of the transaction."
"But," I persisted, "if you really believe that he may be alive, I should hardly have thought that you would take the responsibility of presuming his death and dispersing his property."
"I don't," said Mr. Jellicoe. "I take no responsibility. I act in accordance with the decision of the court and have no choice in the matter."
"But the court may decide that he is dead and he may nevertheless be alive."
"Not at all. If the court decides that he is presumably dead, then he is presumably dead. As a mere irrelevant physical circumstance, he may, it is true, be alive. But legally speaking, and for testamentary purposes, he is dead. You fail to perceive the distinction, no doubt?"
"I'm afraid I do," I admitted.
"Yes, the members of your profession usually do. That is what makes them such bad witnesses in the court of law. The scientific outlook is radically different from the legal. The man of science relies on his own knowledge and observation and judgment, and disregards testimony. A man comes to you and tells you he is blind in one eye. Do you accept his statement? Not in the least. You proceed to test his eyesight with some infernal apparatus of colored glasses, and you find that he can see perfectly well with both eyes. Then you decide that he is not blind in one eye. That is to say, you reject his testimony in favor of facts of your own ascertaining."
"But surely that is the rational method of coming to a conclusion?"
"In science, no doubt, not in law. A court of law must decide according to the evidence which is before it, and that evidence is of the nature of sworn testimony. If a witness is prepared to swear that black is white and no evidence to the contrary is offered, the evidence before the court is that black is white, and the court must decide accordingly. The judge and jury may think otherwise. They may even have private knowledge to the contrary. But they have to decide according to the evidence."
"Do you mean to say that a judge would be justified in giving a decision which he knew to be contrary to the facts? Or that he might sentence a man whom he knew to be innocent?"
"Certainly. It has been done. There is a case of a judge who sentenced a man to death and allowed the execution to take place, notwithstanding that he, the judge, had actually seen the murder committed by another man. But that was carrying correctness of procedure to the verge of pedantry."
"It was with a vengeance," I agreed. "But to return to the case of John Bellingham. Supposing that after the court has decided that he is dead, he should return alive, what then?"
"Ah, it would then be his turn to make an application, and the court, having fresh evidence laid before it, would probably decide that he was alive."
"And meantime his property would have been dispersed?"
"Probably, but you will observe that the presumption of death would have arisen out of his own proceedings. If a man acts in such a way as to create a belief that he is dead, he must put up with the consequences."
"Yes, that is reasonable enough," said I, and then after a pause I asked, "Is there any immediate likelihood of proceedings of the kind being commenced?"
"I understood from what you said just now that Mr. Hurst was contemplating some action of the kind. No doubt you had your information from a reliable quarter." This answer Mr. Jellicoe delivered without moving a muscle, regarding me with the fixity of a spectacled figurehead. I smiled feebly. The operation of pumping Mr. Jellicoe was rather like the sport of boxing with a porcupine, being chiefly remarkable as a demonstration of the power of passive resistance. I determined, however, to make one more effort, rather, I think, for the pleasure of witnessing his defensive maneuvers, than with the expectation of getting anything out of him. I accordingly opened out on the subject of the remains.
"Have you been following these remarkable discoveries of human bones that have been appearing in the papers?" I asked. He looked at me stonily for some moments and then replied, "Human bones are rather more within your province than mine, but now that you mention it, I think I recall having read of some such discoveries. They were disconnected bones, I believe." "Yes, evidently parts of a dismembered body." "So I should suppose. No, I have not followed the accounts. As we get on in life, our interests tend to settle into grooves, and my groove is chiefly connected with conveyancing. These discoveries would be of more interest to a criminal lawyer." "I thought you might perhaps have connected them with the disappearance of your client." "Why should I? What could be the nature of the connection?" "Well," I said, "these are the bones of a man." "Yes, and my client was a man with bones. That is a connection, certainly, though not a very specific or distinctive one. But perhaps you had something more particular in your mind?" "I had," I replied. "The fact that some of the bones were actually found on land belonging to your client seemed to me rather significant."
"Did it indeed?" said Mr. Jellicoe.
He reflected for a few moments, gazing steadily at me the while, and then continued, "In that I am unable to follow you. It would have seemed to me that the finding of human remains upon a certain piece of land might conceivably throw a prima facie suspicion upon the owner or occupant of the land as being the person who deposited them. But the case that you suggest is the one case in which this would be impossible. A man cannot deposit his own dismembered remains." "No, of course not. I was not suggesting that he deposited them himself, but merely that the fact of their being deposited on his land in a way connected these remains with him." "Again," said Mr. Jellicoe, "I fail to follow you, unless you are suggesting that it is customary for murderers who mutilate bodies to be punctilious in depositing the dismembered remains upon land belonging to their victims. In which case I am skeptical as to your facts. I am not aware of the existence of any such custom. Moreover, it appears that only a portion of the body was deposited on Mr. Bellingham's land, the remaining portions having been scattered broadcast over a wide area. How does that agree with your suggestion?" "It doesn't, of course," I admitted, "but there is another fact that I think you will admit to be more significant. The first remains that were discovered were found at Sidcup. Now Sidcup is close to Eltham, and Eltham is the place where Mr. Bellingham was last seen alive." "And what is the significance of this? Why do you connect the remains with one locality rather than the various other localities in which other portions of the body were found?" "Well," I replied, rather graveled by this very pertinent question, "the appearances seem to suggest that the person who deposited these remains started from the neighborhood of Eltham, where the missing man was last seen." Mr. Jellicoe shook his head. "You appear," said he, "to be confusing the order of deposition with the order of discovery. What evidence is there that the remains found at Sidcup were deposited before those found elsewhere?" "I don't know that there is any," I admitted. "Then," said he, "I don't see how you support your suggestion that the person started from the neighborhood of Eltham." On consideration, I had to admit that I had nothing to offer in support of my theory, and having thus shot my last arrow in this very unequal contest, I thought it time to change the subject. "I called in at the British Museum the other day," said I, "and had a look at Mr. Bellingham's last gift to the nation. The things are very well shown in that central case." "Yes, I was very pleased with the position they have given to the exhibit, and so would my poor old friend have been. I wished, as I looked at the case, that he could have seen it, but perhaps he may after all." "I am sure I hope he will," said I, with more sincerity perhaps than the lawyer gave me credit for. For the return of John Bellingham would most effectually have cut the Gordian knot of my friend Godfrey's difficulties. "You are a good deal interested in Egyptology yourself, aren't you?" I added. "Greatly interested," replied Mr. Jellicoe, with more animation than I had thought possible in his wooden face. "It is a fascinating subject, the study of this venerable civilization, extending back to the childhood of the human race, preserved forever for our instruction in its own unchanging monuments, like a fly in a block of amber. Everything connected with Egypt is full of impressive solemnity. A feeling of permanence, of stability, defying time and change pervades it. The place, the people, and the monuments alike breathe of eternity. I was mightily surprised at this rhetorical outburst on the part of this dry, taciturn lawyer. But I liked him the better for the touch of enthusiasm that made him human and determined to keep him astride of his hobby. "Yet," said I, "the people must have changed in the course of centuries." "Yes, that is so. The people who fought against Cambyses were not the race who marched into Egypt 5,000 years before, the dynastic people whose portraits we see on the early monuments. In those 50 centuries, the blood of Hyksos and Syrians and Ethiopians and Hittites, and who can say how many more races, must have mingled with that of the old Egyptians. But still the national life went on without a break. The old culture leavened the new peoples, and the immigrant strangers ended by becoming Egyptians. It is a wonderful phenomenon. Looking back on it from our own time, it seems more like a geological period than the life history of a single nation. Are you at all interested in the subject?" "Yes, decidedly, though I am completely ignorant of it. The fact is that my interest is of quite recent growth. It is only of late that I have been sensible of the glamour of things Egyptian." "Since you made Miss Bellingham's acquaintance, perhaps," suggested Mr. Jellicoe, himself as unchanging in aspect as an Egyptian effigy. "I suppose I must have reddened." I certainly resented the remark, for he continued in the same even tone, "I made the suggestion because I know that she takes an intelligent interest in the subject and is, in fact, quite well informed on it." "Yes, she seems to know a great deal about the antiquities of Egypt, and I may as well admit that your surmise was correct. It was she who showed me her uncle's collection." "So I had supposed," said Mr. Jellicoe. "And a very instructive collection it is, in a popular sense, very suitable for exhibition in a public museum, though there is nothing in it of unusual interest to the expert. The tomb furniture is excellent of its kind, and the cartonnage case of the mummy is well made and rather finely decorated." "Yes, I thought it quite handsome. But can you explain to me why, after taking all that trouble to decorate it, they should have disfigured it with those great smears of bitumen?" "Ah," said Mr. Jellicoe, "that is quite an interesting question. It is not unusual to find mummy cases smeared with bitumen. There is a mummy of a priestess in the next gallery which is completely coated with bitumen except the gilded face. Now, this bitumen was put on for a purpose, for the purpose of obliterating the inscriptions and thus concealing the identity of the deceased from the robbers and desecrators of tombs. And there is the oddity of this mummy of Sebek-Hotep. Evidently there was an intention of obliterating the inscriptions. The whole of the back is covered thickly with bitumen, and so are the feet. Then the workers seem to have changed their minds and left the inscriptions and decoration untouched. Why they intended to cover it, and why, having commenced, they left it partially covered only, is a mystery. The mummy was found in its original tomb and quite undisturbed, so far as tomb robbers are concerned. Poor Bellingham was greatly puzzled as to what the explanation could be." "Speaking of bitumen," said I, "reminds me of a question that has occurred to me. You know that this substance has been used a good deal by modern painters, and that it has a very dangerous peculiarity. I mean its tendency to liquefy, without any obvious reason, long after it has dried." "Yes, I know. Isn't there some story about a picture of Reynolds in which bitumen had been used? A portrait of a lady, I think. The bitumen softened, and one of the lady's eyes slipped down onto her cheek, and they had to hang the portrait upside down and keep it warm until the eye slipped back again into its place. But what was your question?" "I was wondering whether the bitumen used by the Egyptian artists has ever been known to soften after this great lapse of time." "Yes, I think it has. I have heard of instances in which the bitumen coatings have softened under certain circumstances and become quite tacky. But bless my soul, here am I gossiping with you and wasting your time, and it is nearly 9:15. My guest rose hastily, and I, with many apologies for having detained him, proceeded to fulfill my promise to guide him to his destination. As we sallied forth together, the glamour of Egypt faded by degrees, and when he shook my hand stiffly at the gate of the Bellinghams' house, all his vivacity and enthusiasm had vanished, leaving the taciturn lawyer dry, uncommunicative, and not a little suspicious. End of chapter 9.
Chapter 10 of The Eye of Osiris by R. Austin Freeman. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 10. The New Alliance. The great lexicographer, tutelary deity of my adopted habitat, has handed down to shuddering posterity a definition of the act of eating which might have been framed by a dyspeptic ghoul. Eat. To devour with the mouth. It is a shocking view to take a so genial a function, cynical, indelicate, and finally unforgivable by reason of its very accuracy. For after all, that is what eating amounts to, if one must needs express it with such crude brutality. But if the ingestion of elementary substances, to ring a modern change upon the older formula, is in itself a process material even unto carnality, it is undeniable that it forms a highly agreeable accompaniment to more psychic manifestations. And so, as the lamplight, reinforced by accessory candles, falls on the little table in the first-floor room looking on Fetter Lane, only now the curtains are drawn, the conversation is not the less friendly and bright for a running accompaniment executed with knives and forks, for a clink of goblet and jovial gurgle of wine-flask. On the contrary, to one of us at least, to wit Godfrey Bellingham, the occasion is one of uncommon festivity, and his boyish enjoyment of the simple feast makes pathetic suggestions of hard times, faced uncomplainingly, but keenly felt nevertheless. The talk flitted from topic to topic, mainly concerning itself with matters artistic, and never for one moment approaching the critical subject of John Bellingham's will. From the stepped pyramid of Saqqara with its encaustic tiles to medieval church floors, from Elizabethan woodwork to Mycenaean pottery, and thence to the industrial arts of the Stone Age and the civilization of the Aztecs. I began to suspect that my two legal friends were so carried away by the interests of the conversation that they had forgotten the secret purpose of the meeting. For the dessert had been placed on the table, by Mrs. Gummer with the manner of a bereaved dependent dispensing funeral bake-meats, and still no reference had been made to the case. But it seemed that Thorndyke was but playing a waiting game, was only allowing the intimacy to ripen while he watched for the opportunity. And that opportunity came, even as Mrs. Gummer vanished spectrally with a tray of plates and glasses. "So you had a visitor last night, Doctor," said Mr. Bellingham. "I mean my friend Jellicoe. He told us he had seen you, and mighty curious he was about you. I have never known Jellicoe to be so inquisitive before. What did you think of him?" "A quaint old cock. I found him highly amusing. We entertained one another for quite a long time with cross questions and crooked answers, I affecting eager curiosity, he replying with a defensive attitude of universal ignorance. It was a most diverting encounter." "He needn't have been so close," Miss Bellingham remarked, "seeing that all the world will be regaled with our affairs before long." "They are proposing to take the case into court, then?" said Thorndyke. "Yes," said Mr. Bellingham. "Jellicoe came to tell me that my cousin Hurst has instructed his solicitors to make the application and to invite me to join him. Actually, he came to deliver an ultimatum from Hurst, but I mustn't disturb the harmony of this festive gathering with litigious discords." "Now, why mustn't you?" asked Thorndyke. "Why is a subject in which we are all keenly interested to be taboo? You don't mind telling us about it, do you?" "No, of course not. But what do you think of a man who buttonholes a doctor at a dinner party to retail a list of ailments?" "It depends on what his ailments are," replied Thorndyke. "If he is a chronic dyspeptic and wishes to expound the virtues of Dr. Snaffler's purple pills for pimply people, he is merely a bore. But if he chances to suffer from some rare and choice disease, such as trypanosomiasis or acromegaly, the doctor will be delighted to listen." "Then are we to understand," Miss Bellingham asked, "that we are rare and choice products in a legal sense?" "Undoubtedly," replied Thorndyke. "The case of John Bellingham is, in many respects, unique. It will be followed with the deepest interest by the profession at large, and especially by medical jurists." "How gratifying that should be to us," said Miss Bellingham. "We may even attain undying fame in textbooks and treatises, and yet we are not so very much puffed up with our importance."
No, said her father, we could do without the fame quite well, and so I think could Hearst.
Did Berkeley tell you of the proposal that he made?
Yes, said Thorndyke, and I gather from what you say that he has repeated it.
Yes, he sent Jellicoe to give me another chance, and I was tempted to take it, but my daughter was strongly against any compromise, and probably she is right. At any rate, she is more concerned than I am.
What view did Mr. Jellicoe take? Thorndyke asked.
Oh, he was very cautious and reserved, but he didn't disguise his feeling that I should be wise to take a certainty in lieu of a very problematical fortune. He would certainly like me to agree, for he naturally wishes to get the affair settled and pocket his legacy.
And have you definitely refused?
Yes, quite definitely. So Hearst will apply for permission to presume death and prove the will, and Jellicoe will support him. He says he has no choice.
And you?
I suppose I shall oppose the application, though I don't quite know on what grounds.
Before you take definite steps, said Thorndyke, you ought to give the matter very careful consideration. I take it that you have very little doubt that your brother is dead. And if he is dead, any benefit that you may receive under the will must be conditional on the previous presumption or proof of death. But perhaps you have taken advice?
No, I have not. As our friend the doctor has probably told you, my means, or rather lack of them, do not admit of my getting professional advice. Hence my delicacy about discussing the case with you.
Then do you propose to conduct your case in person?
Yes, if it is necessary for me to appear in court, as I suppose it will be, if I oppose the application.
Thorndyke reflected for a few moments and then said gravely, "You had much better not appear in person to conduct your case, Mr. Bellingham, for several reasons. To begin with, Mr. Hearst is sure to be represented by a capable counsel, and you will find yourself quite unable to meet the sudden exigencies of a contest in court. You will be outmaneuvered. Then there is the judge to be considered."
"But surely one can rely on the judge dealing fairly with a man who is unable to afford a solicitor and counsel?"
"Undoubtedly, as a rule, a judge will give an unrepresented litigant every assistance and consideration. English judges in general are high-minded men with a deep sense of their great responsibilities. But you cannot afford to take any chances. You must consider the exceptions. A judge has been a counsel, and he may carry to the bench some of the professional prejudices of the bar. Indeed, if you consider the absurd license permitted to counsel in their treatment of witnesses, and the hostile attitude adopted by some judges toward medical and other scientific men who have to give their evidence, he will see that the judicial mind is not always quite as judicial as one would wish, especially when the privileges and immunities of the profession are concerned. Now, your appearance in person to conduct your case must unavoidably cause some inconvenience to the court. Your ignorance of procedure and legal details must occasion some delay. And if the judge should happen to be an irritable man, he might resent the inconvenience and delay. I don't say that this would affect his decision. I don't think it would, but I am sure it would be wise to avoid giving offense to the judge. And above all, it is most desirable to be able to detect and reply to any maneuvers on the part of the opposing counsel, which you certainly would not be able to do.
This is excellent advice, Dr. Thorndyke, said Bellingham, with a grim smile. But I'm afraid I shall have to take my chance.
Not necessarily, said Thorndyke. I am going to make a little proposal, which I will ask you to consider without prejudice as a mutual accommodation. You see, your case is one of exceptional interest. It will become a textbook case, as Miss Bellingham prophesied. And since it lies within my specialty, it will be necessary for me to follow it in the closest detail. Now, it would be much more satisfactory to me to study it from within than from without, to say nothing of the credit which would accrue to me if I should be able to conduct it to a successful issue. I am therefore going to ask you to put your case in my hands and let me see what can be done with it. I know this is an unusual course for a professional man to take, but I think it is not improper under the circumstances.
Mr. Bellingham pondered in silence for a few moments, and then, after a glance at his daughter, began rather hesitatingly, "It's very generous of you, Dr. Thorndyke."
"Pardon me," interrupted Thorndyke, "it is not.
My motives, as I have explained, are purely egoistic."
Mr. Bellingham laughed uneasily, and again glanced at his daughter, who, however, pursued her occupation of peeling a pear with calm deliberation and without lifting her eyes. Getting no help from her, he asked, "Do you think that there is any possibility whatever of a successful issue?"
"Yes, a remote possibility, very remote, I fear, as things look at present. But if I thought the case absolutely hopeless, I should advise you to stand aside and let events take their course."
"Supposing the case should come to a favorable termination, would you allow me to settle your fees in the ordinary way?"
"If the choice lay with me," replied Thorndyke, "I should say yes with pleasure. But it does not. The attitude of the profession is very definitely unfavorable to speculative practice. You may remember the well-known firm of Dodson and Fogg, who gained thereby much profit but little credit. But why discuss contingencies of this kind? If I bring your case to a successful issue, I shall have done very well for myself. We shall have benefited one another mutually. Come now, Miss Bellingham, I appeal to you. We have eaten salt together, to say nothing of pigeon pie and other cakes. Won't you back me up, and at the same time do a kindness to Dr. Berkeley?"
"Why, is Dr. Berkeley interested in our decision?"
"Certainly he is, as you will appreciate when I tell you that he actually tried to bribe me secretly out of his own pocket."
"Did you?" she asked, looking at me with an expression that rather alarmed me.
"Well, not exactly," I replied, mighty hot and uncomfortable, and wishing Thorndyke at the devil with his confidences. "I merely mentioned that the solicitor's costs, you know, and that sort of thing. But you needn't jump on me, Miss Bellingham. Dr. Thorndyke did all that was necessary in that way." She continued to look at me thoughtfully as I stammered out my excuses, and then said, "I wasn't going to. I was only thinking that poverty has its compensations. You are all so very good to us, and for my part I should accept Dr. Thorndyke's generous offer most gratefully, and thank him for making it so easy for us."
"Very well, my dear," said Mr. Bellingham. "We will enjoy the sweets of poverty, as you say. We have sampled the other kind of thing pretty freely, and do ourselves the pleasure of accepting a great kindness, most delicately offered."
"Thank you," said Thorndyke. "You have justified my faith in you, Miss Bellingham, and in the power of Dr. Berkeley's salt. I understand that you place your affairs in my hands."
"Entirely and thankfully," replied Mr. Bellingham. "Whatever you think best to be done, we agree to beforehand."
"Then," said I, "let us drink success to the cause. Port, if you please, Miss Bellingham. The vintage is not recorded, but it is quite wholesome, and a suitable medium for the sodium chloride of friendship." I filled her glass, and when the bottle had made its circuit, we stood up and solemnly pledged the new alliance.
"There is just one thing I would say before we dismiss the subject for the present," said Thorndyke. "It is a good thing to keep one's own counsel. When you get formal notice from Mr. Hurst's solicitors that proceedings are being commenced, you may refer them to Mr. Marchmont of Gray's Inn, who will nominally act for you. He will actually have nothing to do, but we must preserve the fiction that I am instructed by a solicitor. Meanwhile, and until the case goes into court, I think it very necessary that neither Mr. Jellicoe nor anyone else should know that I am connected with it. We must keep the other side in the dark, if we can."
"We will be as secret as the grave," said Mr. Bellingham, "and as a matter of fact it will be quite easy, since it happens, by a curious coincidence, that I am already acquainted with Mr. Marchmont. He acted for Stephen Blackmore, you remember, in that case that you unraveled so wonderfully. I knew the Blackmores."
"Did you?" said Thorndyke. "What a small world it is! And what a remarkable affair that was!
The intricacies and cross-issues made it quite absorbingly interesting, and it is noteworthy for me in another respect, for it was one of the first cases in which I was associated with Dr. Jervis."
"Yes, and a mighty useful associate I was," remarked Jervis, "though I did pick up one or two facts by accident. And by the way, the Blackmore case had certain points in common with your case, Mr. Bellingham. There was a disappearance and a disputed will, and the man who vanished was a scholar and an antiquarian. Cases in our specialty are apt to have certain general resemblances," Thorndyke said, and as he spoke he directed a keen glance at his junior, the significance of which I partly understood when he abruptly changed the subject.
The newspaper reports of your brother's disappearance, Mr. Bellingham, were remarkably full of detail. There were even plans of your house and that of Mr. Hurst. Do you know who supplied the information?
No, I don't, replied Mr. Bellingham. I know that I didn't.
Some newspaper men came to me for information, but I sent them packing.
So I understand did Hurst.
And as for Jellicoe, you might as well cross-examine an oyster.
Well, said Thorndyke, the pressmen have queer methods of getting copy, but still someone must have given them that description of your brother and those plans. It would be interesting to know who it was. However, we don't know, and now let us dismiss these legal topics with suitable apologies for having introduced them.
And perhaps, said I, we may as well adjourn to what we call the drawing-room. It is really Barnard's den, and leave the housekeeper to wrestle with the debris.
We migrated to the cheerfully shabby little apartment, and when Mrs. Gummer had served coffee, with gloomy resignation, as who should say, if you will drink this sort of stuff, I suppose you must, but don't blame me for the consequences, I settled Mr. Bellingham in Barnard's favorite lopsided easy-chair, the depressed seat of which suggested its customary use by an elephant of sedentary habits, and opened the diminutive piano.
I wonder if Miss Bellingham would give us a little music, I said.
I wonder if she could, was the smiling response. Do you know, she continued, I have not touched a piano for nearly 2 years?
It will be quite an interesting experiment to me, but if it fails, you will be the sufferers, so you must choose.
My verdict, said Mr. Bellingham, is fiat experimentum, though I won't complete the quotation, as that would seem to disparage Dr. Barnard's piano. But before you begin, Ruth, there is one rather disagreeable matter that I want to dispose of, so that I may not disturb the harmony with it later.
He paused, and we all looked at him expectantly.
I suppose, Dr. Thorndyke, he said, you read the newspapers?
I don't, replied Dr. Thorndyke, but I ascertain for purely business purposes what they contain.
Then, said Mr. Bellingham, you have probably met with some accounts of the finding of certain human remains, apparently portions of a mutilated body.
Yes, I have seen those reports and filed them for future reference.
Exactly.
Well, now, it can hardly be necessary for me to tell you that those remains, the mutilated remains of some poor murdered creature, as there can be no doubt they are, have seemed to have a very dreadful significance for me. You will understand what I mean, and I want to ask you if they have made a similar suggestion to you.
Thorndyke paused before replying, with his eyes bent thoughtfully on the floor, and we all looked at him anxiously.
It's very natural, he said at length, that you should associate these remains with the mystery of your brother's disappearance. I should like to say that you are wrong in doing so, but if I did, I should be uncandid. There are certain facts that do undoubtedly seem to suggest a connection, and up to the present there are no definite facts of a contrary significance.
Mr. Bellingham sighed deeply and shifted uncomfortably in his chair.
It is a horrible affair, he said huskily. Horrible! Would you mind, Dr. Thorndyke, telling us just how the matter stands in your opinion, what the probabilities are, for and against?
Again Thorndyke reflected a while, and it seemed to me that he was not very willing to discuss the subject. However, the question had been asked pointedly, and eventually he answered.
At the present stage of the investigation, it is not very easy to state the balance of probabilities. The matter is still quite speculative. The bones which have been found hitherto, for we are dealing with a skeleton, not with a body, have been exclusively those which are useless for personal identification, which is in itself a rather curious and striking fact. The general character and dimensions of the bones seems to suggest a middle-aged man of about your brother's height, and the date of deposition appears to be in agreement with the date of his disappearance.
Is it known, then, when they were deposited? Asked Mr. Bellingham.
In the case of those found at Sitka, it seems possible to deduce an approximate date. The watercress bed was cleaned out about 2 years ago, so they could not have been lying there longer than that, and their condition suggests that they could not have been there much less than 2 years, as there is apparently no vestige of the soft structures left. Of course, I am speaking from the newspaper reports only. I have no direct knowledge of the matter.
Have they found any considerable part of the body yet? I haven't been reading the papers myself. My little friend Miss Oman brought a great bundle of them for me to read, but I couldn't stand it.
I pitched the whole boiling of him out of the window. I thought I detected a slight twinkle in Thorndyke's eye, but he answered quite gravely. I think I can give you the particulars from memory, though I won't guarantee the dates. The original discovery was made, apparently quite accidentally, at Sidcup on the 15th of July. It consisted of a complete left arm, minus the third finger, and including the bones of the shoulder blade and collarbone. This discovery seems to have set the local population, especially the juvenile part of it, searching all the ponds and streams of the neighborhood.
Cannibals, interjected Mr. Bellingham.
With the result that there was dredged up out of a pond near St. Mary Cray in Kent a right thigh bone. There is a slight clue to identity in respect of this bone, since the head of it has a small patch of eburnation, that is a sort of porcelain-like polish that occurs on the parts of bones that form a joint when the natural covering of cartilage is destroyed by disease. It is produced by the unprotected surface of the bone grinding against the similarly unprotected surface of another.
And how, Mr. Bellingham asked, would that help the identification?
It would indicate, Thorndyke replied, that the deceased had probably suffered from rheumatoid arthritis, what is commonly known as rheumatic gout, and he would probably have limped slightly and complained of some pain in the right hip.
I am afraid that doesn't help us very much, said Mr. Bellingham, for you see, John had a pretty pronounced limp from another cause, an old injury to his left ankle, and as to complaining of pain, well, he was a hardy old fellow, and not much given to making complaints of any kind. But don't let me interrupt you.
The next discovery, continued Thorndyke, was made near Lee, by the police this time. They seemed to have developed sudden activity in the matter, and in searching the neighborhood of West Kent, they dragged out of a pond near Lee the bones of a right foot. Now, if it had been the left instead of the right, we might have a clue, as I understand your brother had fractured his left ankle. And there might have been some traces of the injury on the foot itself.
Yes, said Mr. Bellingham, I suppose there might. The injury was described as a Potts fracture.
Exactly. Well, now, after this discovery at Lee, it seems that the police set on foot a systematic search of all the ponds and small pieces of water around London, and on the 23rd they found in the cuckoo pits in Epping Forest, not far from Woodford, the bones of a right arm, including those of the shoulder as before, which seemed to be part of the same body.
Yes, said Mr. Bellingham, I heard of that.
Quite close to my old house.
Horrible, horrible!
It gave me the shudders to think of it, to think that poor old John may have been waylaid and murdered when he was actually coming to see me. He may have got into the grounds by the back gate, if it was left unfastened, and been followed in there and murdered. You remember that a scarab from his watch chain was found there? But is it clear that this arm was the fellow of the arm that was found at Sidcup?
It seems to agree in character and dimensions, said Thorndyke, and the agreement is strongly supported by a discovery made 2 days later.
What is that? Mr. Bellingham demanded.
It is the lower half of a trunk which the police dragged out of a rather deep pond on the skirts of the forest at Loughton, Staples Pond it is called. The bones found were the pelvis, that is, the two hip bones, and six vertebrae, or joints of the backbone. Having discovered these, the police dammed the stream and pumped the pond dry, but no other bones were found, which is rather odd, as there should have been a pair of ribs belonging to the upper vertebra, the 12th dorsal vertebra. It suggests some curious questions as to the method of dismemberment, but I mustn't go into unpleasant details. The point is that the cavity of the right hip joint showed a patch of eburnation corresponding to that on the head of the right thigh bone that was found at St. Mary Cray. So there can be very little doubt that these bones are all part of the same body.
I see, grunted Mr. Bellingham, and he added after a moment's thought, Now the question is, are these bones the remains of my brother John?
What do you say, Dr. Thorndyke?
I say the question cannot be answered on the facts at present known to us. It can only be said that they may be, and that some of the circumstances suggest that they are. But we can only wait for further discoveries. At any moment the police may light upon some portion of the skeleton which will settle the question definitely one way or the other.
I suppose, said Mr. Bellingham, I can't be of any service to you in the matter of identification?
Indeed you can, said Thorndyke, and I was going to ask you to assist me. What I want you to do is this. Write down a full description of your brother, including every detail known to you, together with an account of every illness or injury from which you know him to have suffered, also the names and, if possible, the addresses of any doctors, surgeons, or dentists who might have attended him at any time. The dentists are particularly important, as their information would be invaluable if the skull belonging to these bones should be discovered. Mr. Bellingham shuddered. "It's a shocking idea," he said, "but of course you are right. You must have the facts if you are to form an opinion. I will write out what you want and send it to you without delay. And now, for God's sake, let us throw off this nightmare for a little while at least. What is there, Ruth, among Dr. Barnard's music that you can manage?" Barnard's collection in general inclined to the severely classical, but we disinterred from the heap a few lighter works of an old-fashioned kind, including a volume of Mendelssohn's lighter Unworte, and with one of these Miss Bellingham made trial of her skill, playing it with excellent taste and quite adequate execution. That, at least, was her father's verdict, for as to me, I found it the perfection of happiness merely to sit and look at her, a state of mind that would have been in no wise disturbed even by silvery waves or the maiden's prayer. Thus, with simple, homely music and conversation always cheerful and sometimes brilliant, slipped away one of the pleasantest evenings of my life, and slipped away all too soon. St. Dunstan's clock was the fly in the ointment, for it boomed out intrusively the hour of 11 just as my guests were beginning thoroughly to appreciate one another, and thereby carried the sun, with a minor paternal satellite, out of the firmament of my heaven. For I had, in my professional capacity, given strict injunctions that Mr. Bellingham should on no account sit up late, and now, in my social capacity, I had smilingly to hear the doctor's orders quoted. It was a scurvy return for all my care. When Mr. and Miss Bellingham departed, Thorndyke and Jervis would have gone too, but noting my bereaved condition, and being withal compassionate and tender of heart, they were persuaded to stay a while and bear me company in a consolatory pipe. End of chapter 10.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. TNCs apply. In-app only.